Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. When the Coronado expedition came to New Mexico in 1540, there were 12 to 16 inhabited pueblos just in the middle Rio Grande Valley, with as many as 10 to 20,000 people living here. Matthew Schmader has spent years studying archaeological evidence around this incursion into the Southwest and the battles that ensued with Pueblo people. His new book chronicles his work uncovering Piedras Marcadas Pueblo, a village of over 1,000 rooms, located in what is now Albuquerque. His book, Uncovering America's First War, Contact, Conflict, and Coronado's Expedition to the Rio Grande, was just published by University of New Mexico Press. Schmader is also an adjunct professor in anthropology and says this war has a larger cultural significance beyond the battles.
The larger significance really has to do with the fact that despite everything that happened, Pueblos were able to survive anything that was thrown their way and continue to thrive all the way to the present.
In your introduction, you note that this book was almost impossible to write, and yet it was not possible to leave it unwritten. Say more about that.
Impossible to write in the sense that there's so much information and so many layers, and every time you pursue one layer, it opens up something else. And yet at the same time, I had been working at this particular project for so long and had many iterations of articles and things like that, that I felt like in order to do the entire story justice, it had to be put together, which was a nearly impossible task, but something that had to be done eventually.
What made it so challenging?
What made it so challenging was that as I continued to work, I kept finding out new information. There really is no ultimate finality to it. It's an ongoing process, so you have to collect everything you can as you go and try to hit some logical stopping points, but there are no real end points to it.
For instance, you write a lot about glazeware. Why is that so important when we're reconstructing history?
The Rio Grande glazewares are some of the most beautiful ceramics that were ever made anywhere. It's a testament to the powerful beauty of the Pueblo people that they made these ceramics. The thing about them is that they changed, luckily for archaeologists, they changed fairly regularly. So each Rio Grande glazeware ceramic type really only lasts 100 or so years, 120, 130 years before they change into something else. So they have a beginning point of being made, then of being distributed, then of being curated onto sites, and finally dispensed of on sites. And that's really, for the most part, only 100 years or so.
So that's really helpful for tracking the movement of people, the time period of who was at what site. That
yes.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. In particular, we can pick up certain of the later Rio Grande glazewares and know that they were being produced and in use right at the time of the first contact by outsiders into the Pueblo world.
And you also have a lot of illustrations and talk a lot about, for instance, throwing stones or metals that were left behind in the invading Spanish. What do those tell us?
The different artifact types can sort of generally be distributed out and attributed to different cultures. So the metal, there was no metal in the American Southwest before the arrival of outsiders. So the metal artifacts are arguably assignable to the Europeans. What was harder was that with Coronado, there were many hundreds of Mexican Indian soldiers who came from Central and West Central Mexico, and trying to find artifacts really related to them was a little bit harder. And then ultimately, because the site where I worked had been lived in by Pueblo people for almost 250 years before the arrival of Coronado, trying to segregate out what might have been used before as opposed to what had happened during was a little bit of a challenge. The site is called Piedras Marcadas, which means the village of the marked stones. And it's named after areas in Petroglyph Monument where there are large concentrations of petroglyphs only a mile away, really, from the site.
You had mentioned the people who came with Coronado, and that was one of the things I learned in this book that was surprising to me that most of the people on the expedition were not Spanish, but were indigenous people from Mexico.
That's right. So when the word went out that this expedition was going to get put together, Europeans in central Mexico started to sign up. And in fact, so many signed up that there was fear that they were all going to head out of central Mexico and there would be nobody left to protect the colony of New Spain in Mexico City. So I think as partial response to that, Spanish authorities started to recruit Indios Amigos, they were called, the Mexican soldiers from the Valley of Mexico and then from West Central Mexico. And they had almost four times more Indios Amigos than there were Europeans.
Why were so many people eager to join Coronado's expedition?
There were rumors of riches. The problem is with Coronado, we've tended to oversimplify and just say it was the search for the cities of gold. And that wasn't true. What really the motivation was to try and find an overland route to walk really to, they thought they were walking to the border of China or the edge of Asia. By going north and northwest, if you went far enough, you would get to Asia. So that's what motivation was. And a lot of people signed up. They didn't have anything else. They didn't have inheritances and things like that. So a lot of the second sons and the younger men signed up because there was a good prospect of being on this journey of discovery and maybe of even getting some wealth out of it. The Indios Amigos, there were a number of motivations. Some of them were already in positions of servitude where they owed tribute. Many of the indigenous colonies of New Spain owed tribute to the new Spanish authorities. And so in order to get out or pay off some of their debt obligations, they could do that by working it off. Some of them had motivations to possibly get a little bit of notoriety from success in battle. There was quite a warrior ethic in some communities to succeed as warriors. So there were a number of reasons for it.
And some of them ended up staying?
This is the part of the story I find a little bit more fascinating. You have to read between the lines, but from the point of view of a native indigenous Mexican who goes hundreds of miles away from their home into the Pueblo Southwest with Europeans and then end up even fighting against indigenous people, they must have looked across the way at the indigenous ancestral Pueblo here and said, those people are more like us than we are like Europeans. And a number of them peeled off as the expedition went back to Mexico and stayed behind.
I note you had an anecdote about maybe 100 years after this, an attack on Acoma. Some of them were cursing the Spanish in Nahuatl.
Yeah, the Nahuatl language was sort of the most common denominator of a language to communicate between the Spanish and indigenous people in Mexico. So Nahuatl, it was still being heard in curses being hurled about at Acoma 60 years later.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with Matthew Schmader, author of Uncovering America's First War, Contact, Conflict, and Coronado's Expedition to the Rio Grande, which was just published by UNM Press. He's also an adjunct professor in the anthropology department. There were 12 to 16 inhabited pueblos between Bernalillo and Isleta when Coronado arrived. What was the Pueblo world like at that point in the Rio Grande Valley?
The Pueblo world was really in a remarkable state of social and many different forms of achievement and development in terms of architecture, in terms of ceramic technology. And in this particular area in the Rio Grande Valley of Albuquerque, the ancestral southern Tiwa area, we estimate that there were maybe 10 to 20,000 people living here just before the arrival of Coronado.
The projections you have in the book of what a pueblo would have looked like in a certain area, they were quite large.
They were very large. And Piedras Marcadas turns out to be probably the largest of all of them, of the 12 or 16. It was at times, at its height, it probably had 1,000 rooms laid out in two or three sort of big, almost like apartment complex style 1,000 ground floor rooms, and then there were second story and third story rooms. So the Pueblo itself may have had as many as 1,500 rooms in a couple of different blocks of rooms.
That's astounding.
Yeah.
I liked the culture. You could extrapolate that a lot of life was lived on the roofs.
Yes. A lot of activity took place on the roofs. A lot of activity took place outside and within the interior plaza. When you visit Pueblos today, you'll see the arrangement of residential houses all around a common space in the middle, which is the plaza. And the plaza areas in these ancestral Pueblos were very important. They were used by all the people all the time.
How did the native Puebloans first react to the expedition's arrival, and how did things deteriorate? They seemed to at least welcome or offer things when the Spanish arrived.
What was quite interesting, too, is the amount of communication that had occurred across the ancestral Pueblo world at that time. This was a huge number of people who came up out of nowhere, foreigners. And there was a great deal of knowledge ahead of time. Before the Coronado expedition reached Zuni, there was already an emissary that had walked all the way from Picos to Zuni. So the whole Pueblo world was aware that there was an incursion that was about to happen. But Coronado's forces did not find what they thought they were going to find when they reached Zuni. They, of course, did not make it to Asia or China. And so there was a huge disappointment at that point in time. And they had to decide whether or not to turn back. There was a lot of investment riding on this, or to go ahead, and they explored ahead. And that's what ended up then leading to a lot of the events deteriorating between the expedition and native people.
They clearly were not ready for the extremes of temperature in the high desert. The winter in 1540 and 41 was very cold with a lot of snow. How did that play into the destruction of the Pueblos?
It ends up being one of the main contributing factors. They couldn't have known that they were going into the high desert, walking from sort of the subtropics. And of course, many of the Indios Amigos had never been exposed to much cold. When they end up in the Rio Grande Valley in the ancestral Tiwa area, it is late fall, getting into early winter of, as you said, a very cold winter, and they were completely unprepared. So the response was that Coronado's captains set up the main base camp, and they basically said, we're going to take over this village of yours for shelter for us. The Tiwas were very accommodating. They tried their best to meet whatever they thought the demands were. But as the demands mounted, food was being taken, horses were eating the cornfields, and then blankets and clothing were taken from people in the villages. And so it set up this atmosphere of distrust.
At Arano?
Yes.
And other places, native people who surrendered were actually burned alive. Others had their noses or hands cut off in other battles. Why did the invaders use such brutality?
There are a couple of reasons. I think it's important to understand that the context of what happened in Mexico when it was taken over as Spain's colony comes out of the Spanish, not only the Inquisition, but the Crusades. You had a history of Spanish fighters that acted as if they were coming out of the Crusades and out of the conquest of the Moors in old Spain. There was a lot of brutal practice. Mm. And the other thing was that I think there was a determination to try and really just show who was in control. They resorted to brutality somewhat out of habit and somewhat out of fear that if they didn't, then they may end up getting overrun.
Mm-hmm. The whole basically war lasted 6 months, sometimes called the, is it Tiguas?
Tiwish.
Tiwish.
Yeah.
Tiwish. Sometimes called the Tiwish War. What kinds of weapons did the Spanish bring, and what kinds of defenses did the Pueblos have?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that came out of the ongoing work at the site. It's detailed in the written documents too, but the Spanish main weapons as far as shooting implements go were either the crossbow or the first forms of muskets. So this was a very interesting time militarily because the crossbows were still in common use, but they were beginning to be phased out because the muskets were beginning to be used. Early muskets were unreliable. They didn't fire very accurately or it took time to load them and everything. So that's what the Spanish used, but they only had 20 or 30 muskets and 20 or 30 crossbows. The rest of it were hand, you know, like lances and swords and almost native weaponry that the Spanish had gathered up on their way up.
What about the Pueblos?
And the Pueblos had, for their self-defense, there are very interesting accounts that say that when demands were made by the Spanish, they would read out a document and say, now we demand that you surrender. And
in Spanish.
Yeah, in archaic Spanish,
right.
As if the Pueblos were going to understand this. But they could understand that when the text was finished, the answer would come as was described in the form of many shouts and many and hails of arrows that were. So Pueblo warriors certainly had many arrows, but probably the main thing that helped to stave off a lot of the attacks and beat back anything to try and take over a village were piles of throwing stones. That was the main weapon.
That was impressive because it doesn't seem like those would be very lethal, but I guess they could be.
You see, the Pueblos, the villages themselves, were fairly enclosed, and any openings into the plazas were barricaded off. And so the Spanish and the Indios who were helping them would look at an enclosed village as if almost it was a fortified castle. And so what they would try and do was rush the walls, set up ladders, try and scale the ladders, and then gain access, because that was what was happening in old Spain with the Moors. If you gain access to the center, then basically you can take over. When they tried that at a number of the villages here in the Rio Grande, they were beaten back immediately by piles of stones that had been gathered and thrown down on them. And then they had to retreat and try and figure out what the next response would be. And when we look at what was thrown, I mean, some of them are grinding stones that weigh 10 or 20 pounds. The Pueblo defenders would just pick up their arms and just throw things straight down onto the attackers. And it worked to a great degree because once the initial attacks were beaten back, then usually the Spaniards and the Indios Amigos would withdraw and try to figure out what was the next thing to do.
What other forms of resistance did the Pueblos use?
Some of them were fairly subtle tactics, like trying to encourage the expedition to move on. In other words, they would say, we think we know what you're looking for, and it's not here. It's much further away. So they would try to encourage the expedition to move on. But there was very direct action that was taken fairly early on in the Tiwish War where, for example, the ancestral Tiwa warriors had snuck up and killed some of the Indio Amigo guards and then stole horses. And when they stole the horses, then they took them over to Arenal and captured the horses and ran them around inside the village. So there was very active, almost, I don't want to call it guerrilla warfare, but there were individual guerrilla-type actions that had to be taken because you couldn't meet that amount of force with force. It often happens in situations that are called asymmetrical warfare, where one side has more firepower and the other side has to resort to other kinds of tactics. But the Pueblos were, what they had more than anything else was they had the very survival of their own communities and the entire community fighting together. And they had that in a way that nobody else had.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Matthew Schmader, author of Uncovering America's First War, Contact, Conflict, and Coronado's Expedition to the Rio Grande, which was just published by UNM Press. He's also an adjunct professor in the anthropology department. There was an inquiry into Coronado's expedition by Spanish authorities. Why?
The inquiry happened just a couple years after Coronado's expedition returned back to Mexico City. There were charges that ended up being brought up, and the charges revolved around some of the acts of cruelty that were committed on the Pueblo people. In particular, there were charges that dogs were used against some of the prisoners and against some of the native informants that had been, well, they were basically captured at that point. The other set of charges had to do not only with mistreatment of people, but with the fact that ultimately Coronado had not ever established what could be used as a permanent base of operations. He hadn't really attempted to set up any kind of early colony there. But it revolved more around the atrocities and around the use of dogs.
Mm. What were the lingering impacts of the conquest of Tiwish Pueblo?
Well, for one thing, because the Coronado expedition did not succeed in its goals, and in fact was not only a social failure, but an economic failure as well, the Spanish authorities were not interested in trying to re-pursue what they thought was up here. So for 40 years, New Mexico was basically left alone. But I think the impact on the native populations was so extreme that the social memory of these actions, well, they still, I argue, live on today in some forms. But 40 years after, the next small expeditions come up from Mexico. And when they do, the Tiwas had to be looking at it saying, you mean these people are coming back, even though it was only just a few dozen people.
Do we know how they adapted first to the withdrawal and then also to the return 40 years later?
The first withdrawal, after most of the fighting in the Tiwish War is over in the spring of 1541, Coronado moved on and he went all the way over into the Great Plains as far as the Texas Panhandle and probably Kansas. But not finding what they were looking for and not knowing what else to do, their decision was, we'll go back to the Tiwish Pueblos, the Tiwa Pueblos, for the next winter. And so they came back, and that must have had a horrifying effect. There's not much written about the second winter. But then when they finally left, people followed behind them the whole way, probably making sure that they were really leaving, probably encouraging people, some of the Indios, to stay behind. And once they knew that they had left, then they were able to try to get back to some sort of normalcy. But, you know, all of the villages had been burned. There were hundreds of people that had been killed, many wounded. The impact on the ancestral Tiwa society was really profound.
How did this set the stage for the Pueblo Revolt over 100 years later?
And from my point of view, the seeds of the Pueblo Revolt, or the Pueblo Revolutions, as I'm sort of calling them now, were sown right then. The response of resistance to actions of outsiders who come in and begin to disrupt your world is an immediate response. And indigenous people all the way across central Mexico, northern Mexico, into Arizona, into the Pueblo Southwest, was uniform. There was resistance all along the way, but the greatest resistance had to have been here, where the greatest amount of fighting had taken place. You know, again, there were 10 or 20,000 people living here at that time, and there was a huge amount of impact that rippled through all levels of society for generations. And so I think the seeds of the Pueblo Revolt were sown in 1540.
I thought about it when you touched on this earlier, but in the book you talk about the amazing amount of communication among these pretty far-flung communities. Of course, we see that ultimately play out in the Pueblo Revolt with the runners and the knotted cord.
Yeah, I was really lucky just this weekend to be out on the site with a wonderful group of young Pueblo Youth Action Alliance, that they're called. And they talked a lot about the fact that communication is very broad, that the Pueblo world would interlink, and the role of things like running and moving across the landscape and being integrated was something that was recognized from that point, and something that was a key factor in the Pueblo Revolutions, and something that's still a key factor today. They recognized it.
You write that Pueblo resiliency would have the last word. Talk about that.
Pueblo resiliency. For all of the things that happened to Pueblo people, all across the Southwest, and I focus on the Rio Grande Pueblos and the ancestral Tiwas, but all across the Southwest. When you look at what happens to indigenous people in the entire Western Hemisphere, you understand that many of them were not able to withstand the tremendous amount of impact and forces that were really thrown upon them by outsiders, uninvited, you know, completely out of the blue. And many societies simply ceased to exist in the form that they had. Whether you could call them actually extincted or not is another thing. Some of them, though, never were able to be in any kind of form like they were. The Pueblo people are a very special situation because despite everything that happened, the way their fabric of their world was woven together before the arrival of the outsiders meant that there was so much strength that somehow it could absorb all of these impacts and still come out the other side through a number of mechanisms to be able to survive today and be very, very vibrant. I mean, it is the soul and basis of our life in New Mexico.
Hmm. Matt Schmader, this has been fascinating. Is there anything else you wanted to add I didn't ask?
It's an honor to be able to actually have gotten through all of this and to be given the chance to try to be some kind of a voice for the many people who were impacted and, in a sense, give voice to the voiceless and shine some kind of light or meaning onto this really important era that, as we have just said, is still going on in some form today.
Matt Schmader, thank you so much. Thank you for the book. Thanks for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Matthew Schmader, adjunct professor in anthropology at the University of New Mexico and author of the new book, Uncovering America's First War, Contact, Conflict, and Coronado's Expedition to the Rio Grande, which was just published by UNM Press. You can hear this episode and all our episodes at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick, and thanks for listening to University Showcase on KUNM.